Those on KCNR are those of the hosts, guests, and callers only, and do not necessarily reflect those of the staff, management, or advertisers of KCNR Radio.
Hey KCNR listeners, it's Nathan with the Reading Civic Auditorium. Have you been to ReadingCivic.com lately? I want to shout out huge thanks to all of our patrons throughout the North State who buy tickets to our shows and attend the valuable community events that happen in the auditorium every year. These past 10 years of momentum have been absolutely incredible. Thanks to all of you. Your support and confidence in Advanced Reading has made the impossible possible. As a community who knows how to pull together and show ourselves strong, we have successfully attracted high-quality entertainers and major concert promoters back into the building and put your Reading Civic Auditorium on the map once again. Arts and entertainment culture is thriving, and we have much to celebrate. Never miss a show again. Visit ReadingCivic.com and sign up for our emails for exclusive pre-sale access. We have an unbelievable lineup with new shows being added all the time. Hit ReadingCivic.com today. You'll be glad you did. Shows are always more fun at the Civic.
You about ready for school, son?
That's okay, Mom. Dad's dropping me off.
Why?
Because Dad's ride looks awesome after the new paint job from Mako Collision Repair and Auto Painting Center. They also took out that huge scratch and dent.
I took Dad's car to Mako at 3045 Crossroads Drive.
Oh, okay. It looks sick.
Sick?
Mom, sick means cool.
Sick.
It sounds weird when you say it.
Uh-oh, better call Mako. Mako Collision Repair and Auto Painting Center at 3045 Crossroads Drive. Call today for your free estimate. 530-226-0992. That's 530-226-0992.
I'm celebrating local heroes. Tune in the second Thursday each month at 6.05 p.m. right after the news for Heroes of the North State on North State Now. I'm Michelle Slade. During North State Now, we will speak with your neighbors, friends, family, and community members who give back, not to be recognized, but because it's the right thing to do. During these conversations, we will learn what truly makes our community and the people in it. Join me the second Thursday of each month at 6.05 p.m., right after the news, for Heroes of the North State on North State Now.
Hi, this is Mark from Haven Humane Society. It has been a challenging couple of years, and through it all, our amazing team has continued to save lives. We have so many fantastic animals that are looking for their forever homes, and with adoption fees so low, now is the time to add to your family. With puppies, kittens, dogs, cats, and so many more, we have the perfect addition. Come join our team as a volunteer and help in an area that works for you. Walking dogs, socializing cats, helping in our veterinary hospital, or folding laundry. We have many opportunities and welcome all volunteers. For more information, please visit our website at havenhumane.org or follow us on Facebook. On behalf of the entire Haven team, thank you for all of your continued support as together we get closer every day to a North State with no more homeless pets.
This is Carl Bott and Ted Leidy. We want to invite you to our new show, Man Up, the fourth Thursday of each month, right here on KCNR 96.5 FM and 1460 AM.
Man Up, 6 to 7 p.m., where we explore the lost art of being a man.
Spirits, cigars, and hit the ground running when you get up in the morning. That's what Man Up's going to be about.
Oh, don't forget motorcycles, guns, and hard work every day.
And those things that men talk about when women aren't around.
That's right. Even cooking sometimes.
People, places, and things.
Serving your family, your community, and your country.
Man Up. Fourth Thursday of each month from 6 to 7 p.m. right here on Free Fire Radio.
Now is a great time to prepare for this year's upcoming wildfire season. Reading Electric Utility and City of Reading staff are busy clearing vegetation to mitigate wildfire risk to our facilities and to the community. You can also prepare by trimming back shrubs and tree branches that are closer than 5 feet from your home, clear debris from your roof and gutters, and clear dead vegetation on your property. For information about tree trimming and proximity of power lines, call 530-224-4356. We all need to work together to prevent wildfires in our community.
Where do you go in Shasta County to get advice on the best type of firearm to meet your needs and how to safely carry and use it? The answer is to join the revolution at locally owned Bastiani Arms. Bastiani Arms believes in a better way to serve their customers and providing them with all the information needed to make the right decisions before and after the sale. They have a large selection of guns and ammunition and always special discounts for veterans. Self-protection is your right. Join the revolution at Bastiani Arms, 2539 Larkspur Lane in Reading, 222-8222.
I'm celebrating local heroes. Tune in the second Thursday each month at 6.05 p.m. right after the news for Heroes of the North State on North State Now. I'm Michelle Slade. During North State Now, we will speak with your neighbors, friends, family, and community members who give back, not to be recognized, but because it's the right thing to do. During these conversations, we will learn what truly makes our community and the people in it. Join me the second Thursday of each month at 6:05 p.m., right after the news, for Heroes of the North State on North State Now.
At Shasta Regional Medical Center, we're specialists in emergency care with the experience and training to deliver expert diagnosis and treatment to all emergency patients. Shasta Regional Medical Center is certified as an advanced primary stroke facility and is one of the nation's 50 top cardiovascular hospitals and is a fully accredited chest pain center. In an emergency when every minute has meaning and every second counts, choose Shasta Regional Medical Center, your choice for emergency care. Shasta Regional Medical Center, caring for our community when minutes matter.
What does great pizza and ice-cold beer have in common? Charlie's Tap House and mobile catering, of course. Charlie's Pizza, pasta, and more made from scratch with old family recipes using only the finest ingredients. Charlie's will not disappoint when you bite into the bacon spicy mambo pizza. Get ready for an experience you won't find anywhere else. Call Charlie's today to book their patio for your next birthday, baby shower, anniversary, or any other private party. Remember, everything is homemade using secret family recipes. Be sure to try their famous sundial steak salad with perfectly grilled steak tossed in their homemade tomato vinaigrette dressing. Charlie's Tap House, your ultimate beer experience. Charlie's Tap House rule number one, come for the homemade pizza, stay for the beer wall. Charlie's Tap House rule number two, never stay empty-handed. Charlie's Tap House and mobile catering in two locations, Anderson Outlets and in Reading at the corner of Shasta and East Streets. Charlie's Tap House for dine-in, takeout, or delivery. Ask about booking their patio for your next private event. Charlie's Tap House, bringing family and friends together.
Every Monday from 6 to 8 p.m., join us at Radio Wasteland, your local guide to the unexplained and the unknown. Each week, we cover all things unexplained, from the moving stars in the sky to the things that go bump in the night. Visit us as we explore these topics and more as our in-studio team digs deeper with featured guests and listener call-ins. Mondays are rough, but now your overworked brain has a chance for some sweet relief with Radio Wasteland.
Radio Wasteland, Mondays at 6 on KCNR.
KCNR 96.5 FM, AM 1460, and online at kcnr1460.com. Join Sue McClain weekday mornings from 6 to 7 for the Sue McClain News Hour, where you'll hear the up-to-the-minute local news, national and international news, weather, sports, and a whole lot more. Followed by Free Fire Radio from 7 a.m. to 9 a.m. with Carl and Linda Bott. From 9 to noon, be informed and laugh along with Armstrong and Getty, equal opportunity critics. From noon to 3, learn how to get out of debt with Dave Ramsey. From 3 to 6, don't miss constitutional expert Mark Levin. Monday through Thursday nights, starting at 6 p.m., we have local shows featuring everything from the paranormal, local history, North State Now, and unsung heroes of our area. From 7 to 9, tune in to Ben Shapiro, your local downtown radio station, KCNR 96.5 FM, AM 1460, and online at kcnr1460.com.
The tradition continues at the Dry Creek Station at 22025 Highway 299 East in Bella Vista, featuring delicious steaks and seafood, chicken soup, salads, and much more. The Dry Creek Station, family-owned and operated, open since 1992, serving dinner Tuesday through Sunday from 5 to 9 p.m. with happy hour from 3 to 5. The Dry Creek Station is famous for their steamer clams. Friday through Sunday, don't miss their fabulous weekend specials. The Dry Creek Station at 22025 Highway 299 East in Bella Vista. So come on down to the Dry Creek Station, where quality and value meet.
Tobacco and Brew, located at 2143 Hilltop Drive, has been an integral part of our community for over 40 years. They have supported the veterans, law enforcement, fire and disaster survivors throughout this whole time. Tobacco and Brew has expanded their walk-in humidor and brought to the North State new lines of fine cigars, pipes, and tobacco products. Additionally, they are offering a pipe bar to try out new tobacco for taste and aroma. Tobacco and Brew is your one-stop shop for any tobacco product and accessories to include lighters, humidors, pouches, and more. Tobacco and Brew, 2143 Hilltop Drive.
Remodeled kitchen, bathroom, or backyard patio? There's a lot of choices, but only one leader, Estate Granite.
Mike Huber has such a professional attitude and a can-do work ethic that makes him a joy to work with. Mike and his crew worked to have our new kitchen finished in 5 days. We came back to a true work of art.
Hi, this is Brian Filato, broker and co-owner of The Real Estate Group. In today's competitive market, I think what's important is that the house is dialed in and turnkey. And what's important is that the kitchen has been renovated, the bathrooms have been renovated, granite, beautiful cabinetry. Those things make a significant difference.
Mike at Estate Granite has an eye for detail, an attention to perfection, and a quality build crew that are masters of their craft.
Mike was there from start to finish.
Hi, this is Mike from Estate Granite. I know how important quality to a homeowner is, so give me a call at 241-STONE or come by our showroom at 4900 Mountain Lakes Boulevard or visit us at estategranite.com.
Get the very best of summer with Black Bear Diner's refreshing summer menu, here for a limited time only. Start the day with sweet cream pancakes with fresh strawberries and lemon cream. Or grab a fresh berry chicken salad for lunch. Dig into blackberry burned barbecue ribs for dinner and end with a fresh strawberry lemon cream pie. Pair any of these with a triple berry citrus spritzer or a summer sangria and you're set for summer flavor. Black Bear Diner, 2605 Hilltop Drive in Reading.
Black Bear Diner.
Veterans, did you know that Shasta County Veterans Service Office is open to all veterans who have served our nation? Whether a combat veteran or a member of the reserves with limited active duty time, you have earned benefits. If you have any military benefit or veteran-related questions, call 530-225-5616 or stop by Shasta County Veterans Service Office at 1855 Shasta Street, Redding, California. This message is brought to you by Korean War veteran Senator Maurice Johannesson, former Secretary, California Veterans Affairs.
Tobacco and Brew, located at 2143 Hilltop Drive, has been an integral part of our community for over 40 years. They have supported the veterans, law enforcement, fire and disaster survivors throughout this whole time. Tobacco and Brew has expanded their walk-in humidor and brought to the North State new lines of fine cigars, pipes, and tobacco products. Additionally, they are offering a pipe bar to try out new tobacco for taste and aroma. Tobacco and Brew is your one-stop shop for any tobacco product and accessories to include lighters, humidors, pouches, and more. Tobacco and Brew, 2143 Hilltop Drive.
When a unicorn is slain, men have destroyed again the image of beauty that they seek. Nicholas Stewart Gray.
You're listening to Writing Roots, brought to you by Aspen House Publishing.
Welcome to Writing Roots. I'm Lee Hull.
And I'm Lee Esses.
October is our favorite month because we both really like Halloween. So for this October, we decided to take on the topic of monsters, creatures, things that go bump in the night.
We have been fairly academic over the summer and much of the spring. We wanted to have a little fun with this series. So we are starting with the brightest monsters that we can think of, the wholesome, the good ones. And then we are ending with the darkest monsters of all, the scary ones. As we get closer to Halloween, we're going to have more and more fun in this regard.
Yes. So let's get into today's topic. Monsters associated with good, with light, with purity. Because monsters aren't all evil, dangerous, and out to kill us. The definition of monster is usually just kind of an unusual creature outside of the norm.
Something that's been affected by magic in some way.
And unicorns fit that definition. The oldest reference was in the 4th century AD by a Greek physician. I don't even want to try to say his name. But that physician described unicorns as a wild ass as large as a horse, with a white body, a red head, and dark blue eyes. The horn was about a foot and a half long, and it was red, white, and black. There really isn't any modern description of a unicorn that fits this.
I think when it started getting associated with purity, that was when all things that were good and wholesome were also associated with the color white in Europe, versus evil was dark and black. So I think they moved it toward the white. So our traditional image of a unicorn now is closer to all white, somewhat sparkly.
That description came around in about the 12th century AD. That's when they tried to bring the mythological lore of Greek and Roman beliefs into Christianity. Here's the weird thing, though. They, at that time in the 12th century, were described about the size of a goat. So small, little things, instead of a wild ass as large as a horse.
And along with that image of purity was that a unicorn would only come to a chaste virgin.
A lot of these themes are in the old movie, Legend, that has Tom Cruise, Tim Curry, and a couple of unicorns. Weird show. But it has that kind of theme to it of unicorns are associated with sexual purity.
I mentioned the horn being sort of not only what makes a unicorn unique and sort of by definition a unicorn, but that also tends to be where a lot of the magic is held in this magical creature. And it turns out that they actually bought and sold unicorn horns at one point during medieval Renaissance time.
They were used a lot in the medieval times in alchemical pursuits as a way to cure poison, to identify poison. At least that's their belief. But what were these unicorn horns in reality?
Narwhal horns. It turns out they thought that the Vikings were particularly good at hunting unicorns because they came up with all sorts of unicorn horns. And to give you an idea of how much a horn was worth in that time period, there are records of people trading an entire castle for a unicorn horn. So the Vikings are like, narwhal horns.
They kind of look like unicorn horns.
Lop them off, bring them down. Hey guys, can I have a castle? And they did this, not once, not twice, but for 5 centuries.
Yeah, so great. So Queen Elizabeth in the 1570s had a unicorn horn. She drank out of a unicorn horn cup, and it was actually a narwhal horn. I love the history of unicorns. But it's not just in Western culture that a unicorn-type creature is associated with purity. A lot of Asian cultures have a creature similar to the unicorn. It's often called the Asian unicorn or the Chinese unicorn, but it's called in Chinese the Kilin or in Japanese the Kirin. I'm really sorry. I'm going to be butchering some of these pronunciations. I am trying my best.
I first learned it as a Kirin, K-I-R-I-N, which is the Japanese version of this. But they will occasionally be portrayed as having 2 different horns, but their manes will be going straight up in this, like, magical, defying gravity kind of thing.
And instead of being a normal horse coat that's fur, it, a lot of the times, is scaly. They're almost a dragon mixed with a unicorn look in the sculptures and in the art.
But they were definitely associated with goodness. They were sometimes depicted as flying simply because they didn't want to harm anything, even a blade of grass.
Another thing associated with this is it represents both male and female elements. The name itself is a split between male and female. You have the Ki, which is male, Lin, which is female. That pattern also shows up with another Chinese-based creature associated with purity, and this is the phoenix.
Now, the word phoenix actually comes from Mediterranean, the Phoenicians, but what we're talking about is the bird creature that gets reborn in fire.
So, in Chinese, the name is Feng Wang. Again, the Feng represents male, Wang represents the female, but you also have bases in, like Lee said, the Mediterranean. You have some bases of a similar creature in Egyptian mythology. We just kind of combine and call it all the phoenix now because that's what's become popularized.
Now, for the most part, what comes to mind when I'm thinking phoenix is Harry Potter, where you've got the big bird that's about the size of a peacock, long, beautiful tail, mostly red with highlights of gold throughout it. Some portray it more as an eagle, especially I think the Native American styles of that kind of character in their culture. They tend to be songbirds, as well as creatures that either when they die, they turn into ash, or they must be born from the fire in some way.
And in Christian traditions, the phoenix has become associated with Christ and the resurrection of Christ. You have Islamic traditions that have brought in the phoenix, that they see the phoenix as created by God to have all perfections. And throughout all of it, it is the rebirth, the immortality, the continuing to live and grow in perfection.
A lot of mythological creatures across the world have a lot of similarities. We're going to notice that throughout this whole series. There's a version of whatever There's a water elemental here and a djinn here and the nymph here. There are similarities because we come up with ideas based on the world around us. The next creature we're going to talk about is based on something we all see, but not on this world itself.
While many of us grew up seeing a man on the moon, ancient traditions don't see a person. They see a rabbit.
This one was a new one for me when we were researching the different creatures for this.
So you have essentially two separate parts of the world, the Asian area and the indigenous America area, that came up with their own stories for why there is a rabbit on the moon. But all of them tend to be associated with prosperity, fertility, life, purity.
Rabbits and fertility going hand in hand is not exactly a new concept.
So in the Chinese and other Asian cultures, the moon rabbit is seen as a companion to the moon goddess. And this is the version that creates the antidotes, the elixirs, the herbs for the immortals.
Another story from the Cree Nation in Northern America tells the story of a rabbit that hitched a ride to the moon by hanging onto the legs of a crane, which is why they get all long.
The rabbit just wanted to ride the moon, so it hitched a ride with a crane.
That makes perfect sense.
Yeah. That one in particular explains why you can see a rabbit on the moon and why the crane's legs are so long.
In Mayan culture, the rabbit is also associated with their moon goddess, and they're frequently shown side by side.
Very much like the Chinese background. In Aztec traditions, the god Quetzalcoatl was once living as a human on Earth and thought he would die with no food or water during a long journey, and a rabbit offered himself to the god. As a reward, Quetzalcoatl put the rabbit's image on the moon for people to remember her.
The last critter I wanted to just briefly mention is the Caladrius, which is Roman, and it's an animal that's a bird associated with healing, and it was said to arrive in a king's window. I just thought it was an interesting one to kind of toss into the mix.
So the thing with purity is it's not limited to just animals. We talked about the animals. You can also look into plants, such as the world tree and the lily. Both of those in earth cultures very associated with purity.
And plants as monsters are just kind of fun anyway.
So this whole month is going to be us giving you starting points for your research, because we want to equip you with tools to find interesting things, things that you won't always see.
Or even make up your own monsters, especially if you're doing fantasy or sci-fi, something that doesn't take place on Earth. Making up your own monsters is part and parcel to the world-building process.
And that way you can write your book the way you want it to be, because we should always be
writing selfishly.
If you have a question or comment for our hosts or a topic you'd like us to cover, send us an email at writingroots@aspenhousepublishing.com or find us on Facebook by searching for Aspen House Publishing.
Wherever the art of medicine is loved, there is also a love of humanity. Hippocrates.
You're listening to Writing Roots, brought to you by Aspen House Publishing.
Welcome to Writing Roots. I'm Lee Hull.
And I'm Lee Esses.
Joining us today is Lorraine Woodworth, a nurse. Welcome, Lorraine.
How do you do? Nice to be here.
So tell us a little bit about you and what you do.
All right. I am a registered nurse, and I started in the 90s in Reading. And for some very odd reason, I've always been fascinated with surgical procedures that alter our functions in some way that have to be adapted, and wounds, and things that a lot of people may not be particularly interested in, but it's always fascinated me. So after I finished my bachelor's degree at Chico State, I went on to get a certification in wounds, ostomies, and continence. So that's my area that I function in, and now I'm a hospice nurse. That's kind of the way I've done. I'm semi-retired, but I still do work.
So in a lot of popular media, there's this certain idea of what a nurse is. You know, people will picture the TV shows. How much of that would you say is true?
Well, nursing is one of those most highly respected professions. Statistically, when they do tests or surveys of who you trust, who you don't trust, there are people who will trust their nurse over their doctor. The best nurses, I think, are people who really love the science of it, the interaction with human beings, and the ability to help people. And those that are just punching the clock for a job, well, you know, they're in every line of work, even your doctors and people like that.
So there's this idea that all nurses are kind, gentle, loving, caring kind of characters who are very sensitive souls. Do you find that to be accurate?
Anybody that knows me knows that's not true. I'm sorry. No, not every nurse is. No, not every human being is. It's a tremendous cross-section of humanity is in the nursing profession.
I feel like it would be a lot like police work or fire work of sometimes they start out being bright and hopeful, but over time, with all of the things they deal with, they get a little jaded when it comes to optimism in the world.
Well, a lot of that depends on what area of nursing you're in. In my own personal experience, and that's all I have to go by, people that work in emergency, those are the people that are going to see all kinds of negative aspects of humanity. People that work in surgical floors, you know, they deal with medical doctors and post-operative. Everybody has a different job. I think that some people have a gallows type of humor, and they'll see funny in things that other people would shiver at. But I don't think it's intended to be mean or nasty. It's just you have to in some way protect yourself from some of the things that you see. But I've never met a nurse that's deliberately mean or is totally indifferent to the suffering of people.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think they'd last very long.
So I didn't realize before, and I feel terrible about this now, that there are different kinds of nurses in one hospital.
So let's take the emergency room, for instance. Those nurses are at a specific level of emergency, just stop bleeding, restore breathing. This is what we need to do right immediately. On another floor that we call med-surg, a medical unit, people come in being sick, or they just had surgery and they're having a rather normal recovery or an expected recovery. But that nurse will be specially experienced in taking care of antibiotics and hanging the medicines and watching for reactions to the medicines, looking for infections in the wound, making sure that whatever was sewn up stays sewn up, all those kinds of things. In an ortho floor, an orthopedic surgery floor, you have to know about all kinds of different equipment that people come in with, tractions, and they're all hung differently with things to keep a leg that's been broken in place. I mean, every single floor in a hospital has a specific type of patient that they're dealing with. And then, you know, like you get a person like me, for instance, when I worked in the hospital, if I was working as a wound and ostomy nurse, ostomy means opening external mouth to outside the body, and the word before that or the preface is whatever part of the body has been made into an ostomy. Mm-hmm. You've got the person that needs to be fitted with the appliance, and for it to work, you have to educate them. Or if they have a wound, you just do rounds all day with people that have wounds and come up with treatment plans for them. So there's dialysis nurses, nurses that specialize in kidney dialysis. That's a very specific skill and job. I mean, those are just a few of the things
mm-hmm.
that different nurses are skilled and trained to do.
So for an author, it's very important to, if they have a nurse character, what kind of nurse are they going to be in the story? What
exactly.
do they need to know specifically?
Right. Well, for instance, if you have a character in your writing that has a gunshot wound, the nurse can't be a labor and delivery nurse. I didn't even get into that. You want the nurse that knows what to do when a person comes in with a gunshot wound and have had experience. You know that they're going to need x-ray, they're going to need blood, they're going to need all these things. And so you would expect your character and the nurse in that position to have certain levels of skill. Yeah, you got to know what kind of nurse they are.
So we did have a listener have a question for you. The question
okay.
is, How would diabetes affect a character dying from an infection? I believe this character is writing a post-apocalyptic kind of story where antibiotics aren't readily available.
Oh, well, a diabetic person, if anybody's blood sugar gets to be over 150, the white blood cells do not function efficiently to go after infection. When an infection presents itself, the body itself sets up a defense. And to make it just as simple as possible, when a person has diabetes, their blood is more like syrup than water. The white blood cells can't get to the bacteria in order to break them down and destroy them. So if you don't have artificial antibiotics, then the body's not going to be able to fight its own infection.
Okay.
So get the fluids down and get the blood sugar as normal as you can possibly get it.
Interesting.
But post-apocalyptic, you're not going to have blood sugar medicines either.
Yeah. So do you have any stories that you could share with us that might represent what you do for the authors that are listening?
One of the things that I tell is that you learn from your patients as well. I had a patient, an old man. He wasn't in the hospital for this particular problem. He was sick with something else, and he had an ostomy. I was trying to show him how to do it, kind of, you know, I've been to school. I know how to do this kind of stuff. And he looked at me, and he said, young lady, you don't know what you're doing. If you want to do this as a job, you better learn to listen to the people you're taking care of. So sit down and let me show you something. And I was like, okay. I will learn from this old man. Another story in the ostomy thing. I had a lady who was 87, and we're in the bathroom. I'm trying to show her how to take care of this thing, and she says, well, you know, I've got to get home and start taking care of Oscar. And I said, Oscar? Who's Oscar? I mean, I knew her family by then. She'd been there for 2 weeks. She patted her side. She says, my ostomy. She named it Oscar. and she was gonna learn how to take care of it. Those are the things that you take to your heart every time things don't work out so well. So those are two of my stories I can come up with right off the top of my head.
I love them.
Yep.
So throughout our conversation, you've been throwing out a lot of lingo. What do you think is important for authors to know if they're writing a nurse character, or where can they turn to get and use realistic lingo without it sounding very wrong to somebody who knows what they're talking about?
There's nothing to compete with actually talking to a nurse. But the glossaries that are in nursing textbooks, those are good places, because even if it doesn't answer all your questions, it can give you at least where to start to look for an answer. But I wouldn't put anything in a book that's specific unless you know really what that word means.
Or find yourself a nursing friend to say, hey, does this make sense? Is it real?
Right.
Does it actually apply in this scenario?
I've been asked those questions before, and it's always a challenge to think about it that way. I happen to watch a medical thing, and somebody says something that's really like, oh, come on. You have to say it. You have to mention it out loud, even if you're sitting in a room all by yourself. That wouldn't happen. They wouldn't say that.
I do that with my own job.
Yeah, everybody does.
And I will say, talking from experience, that if you know this nurse outside of this author relationship and you don't preface that this question is about your book, make sure you let them know, hey, I'm asking about motorcycle head wounds for my book, not for somebody that I'm actually
having had that panic attack myself.
Yeah.
Yes, well, we say, for research, then ask the question. Don't ask about gunshot wounds unless you tell somebody that it's for research.
Okay, well, thank you so much for joining us. There's a lot of good information that we have here. Very much appreciate it, and I personally very much appreciate your help in answering these kinds of questions in my own storytelling.
There's nothing more flattering to a person than for somebody to ask their advice, even if it's about a fantasy character in a book. I don't think any nurses will mind being asked these kind of questions. It's very flattering.
so long as the timing is right. If you're in the hospital getting treated for something, that might not be the best time.
Right.
But in anything you do, make sure you always
write selfishly.
If you have a question or comment for our hosts or a topic you'd like us to cover, send us an email at writingroots@aspenhousepublishing.com or find us on Facebook by searching for Aspen House Publishing.
The world is full of obvious things which nobody by any chance ever observes. Sir Arthur Conan Doyle.
You're listening to Writing Roots, brought to you by Aspen House Publishing.
Welcome to Writing Roots. I'm Lee Hull.
And I'm Lee Esses.
Before we get started on today's episode, we want your questions. Every December, we talk about specific questions that we receive from you so we can answer them and make sure that we're addressing your specific needs. So if you have a question, contact us, let us know what it is, so we can answer it for you.
There are a couple ways to do that. You can either find us on Facebook, send us a message that way, or, of course, the email address at the end of this episode is a great way to contact not only your questions, but episode ideas and commentary about how fantastic my voice is.
So let's get into today's episode. What's the topic?
We are talking about using your senses, not just what I see or what I hear, but what I'm tasting, what I'm smelling. This is a common bit of advice you hear from third grade teachers. Make sure you include all five senses in the scene.
The reason why senses are so important is that it immerses the reader into the moment with something that they can connect with that otherwise they wouldn't understand. While most of your readers may not know what, say, a homeless person who lives on the streets most of the time and never gets a shower smells like, you do know what a boy's gym locker room smells like after a day of football practice. These are small little details that you can connect the dots to give them an idea of the senses of what they're seeing, hearing, tasting, because readers want to be in the moment. They want to be in the world, and the senses is how you do that.
Not necessarily strictly smells, although that is a great one to give an idea of environment, but if your character can taste the rain in the air before the storm, that's something your readers can relate to.
So we mentioned earlier the five senses. We're aware that that's probably what you've been taught. That's what we were taught. That's what we were familiar with. But there are so many more senses than just five.
In this particular case, we're talking about ways that we interact with the world, ways that the world gives our brains information. Not necessarily seeing dead people like the sixth sense or an emotional IQ, these other things that are part of the human experience, but literally how you get information from the world.
Physical interactions. The most common that you're going to be using in a book is vision, what they're seeing.
And this tends to be the default for a lot of storytellers because a lot of storytellers also watch TV, also go to the movie theaters. You see and you hear a lot of things in cinema, and therefore when you're seeing the story play out in your head, it's sight and sound based often.
So that's the second sense, is the hearing. Your third is smell. This can be so important. Because people remember smells really well. There are actually studies linking smell with memory. So if you can introduce them to a smell that they are familiar with, you are connecting them with a story on a new level.
Smell is closely intertwined with taste. They're right next to each other on the face, yes, but a lot of the words you're going to use are very similar. That saltiness, that nuttiness. Talk about tea tasting or wine tasting. They will say a perfuminess to the flavor, the bouquet of the wine.
Speaking as someone who has a lot of allergies that affect my sinuses, your smell affects your taste. If I can't smell anything, I really can't taste much. It has to be a very strong flavor for me to taste it.
This particular list has 9 different kinds. We got that list from talkingmatters.com, And what we in kindergarten learned as touch is not only texture, something is soft or silky, but also temperature, something is hot or cold, but also pain.
Which also goes with hot and cold, because a lot of pain is associated either with hot or with cold.
Those are all kind of in the touch category, but I wanted to make sure we talked about each of these separately because there are different ways for your character to interpret their environment. It is not only cold, but it is sharp.
You can also have balance as one of the senses. This is really important for characters who, I don't know, maybe are drunk, maybe got drugged, who are usually very graceful and suddenly find themselves tipping and unable to stand up straight.
Also, if your character has motion sickness or, you know, is on a pirate ship, that sense of balance, especially if it's their first time, takes a little while to get your sea legs.
And then the flip side, get used to land after having sea legs.
And the last sense we're going to talk about kind of goes with balance, and that is proprioception, which is more or less your coordination, your hand-eye coordination.
It's awareness of your body, where it is in relation to things around you.
So I just wrote a scene where a character had a dagger pointed at her kidney. She could guess by his voice how far away his head was, therefore how long the weapon was. So without even looking, she knew where his wrist was, where his elbow, his shoulder. So she could disarm him without looking. That's a great proprioceptive ability and awareness of not only her body, but others around her.
So I want you, our listeners, to think about your main character. What is your main character sensing that you aren't writing into the story? What can you add that will add to the story?
One of the ways that I've dabbled with this in the past is by creating a character who is missing one of these. I have created blind characters just to see if I could get the reader to envision the scene without any sight-based elements around them.
So while you're thinking about your character, what they can use, what may help to remove from them, we want you to follow one rule. Do not use all of the senses at the same time.
Think about your human experience. How often are you aware of all five senses at once, or all nine senses at once?
Most of these are instinctual. Your proprioception especially, your balance, these are instinct. And the only time you notice it is if something is wrong.
And if your character isn't noticing it, then really your reader probably shouldn't be either. That especially is the case for deep POV writers. So somebody who's writing kind of like for first or third person from the character's point of view. If you're writing from an omniscient point of view, it's a little more fluid because you want the reader to be another observer in the story instead of feel like a main character.
So what are the senses good for in writing? What are they used for other than just to give a reader a way to connect?
Understanding these senses and how your character reacts to these senses informs us about the character. Is that smell of chewing gum saccharine, that sickly sweet? Or is it nostalgic? Both of those are very different from each other, but they inform about the character who's interpreting that smell.
It can also be used to set a scene. So you have your character noticing the weather, noticing whether it's light or dark outside, noticing what they can see and hear. When you dig deeper into the other senses, then we really get a feel of that scene.
If your character is stepping into an abandoned house for the first time, that musty smell that's a little bit moist, a little bit almost sweet, a little bit nutty.
Very stale.
I don't have to visually describe the corners of the room to give you an idea of being there, what it's like. If you are setting a scene, you are in cinema, it's called a wide shot. if you are establishing everything that's happening in the moment, using your five senses more than just sight is incredibly helpful.
But again, be careful about using all of them at the same time. Go piece by piece. What do they notice first? What would your character notice first? Would it be the smells? Would it be the sights? And then as you get into the scene, separate it a little bit, get into those further details with the other senses.
And of course, just like those undefinable emotions that we spoke about a week ago, all of those undefinable scents and flavors, similes and metaphors are your friend. She smelled like a warm summer's day. I don't really know what a warm summer's day smells like, but there's an emotion and attachment to that particular scent.
The biggest takeaway from today's episode is consider more. What else does your character experience that will help the reader connect with that character? That is the trick of the trade, getting your readers to connect.
This is really the advantage of a text-based entertainment format, of reading a story versus watching it on TV. You can bring your readers to that moment with all of these other senses. And all of that starts with
writing selfishly.
If you have a question or comment for our hosts or a topic you'd like us to cover, send us an email at writingroots@aspenhousepublishing.com or find us on Facebook by searching for Aspen House Publishing.
A Moment in History by KCNR Radio. In February 1850, Shasta County was created as one of the California's original 27 counties. In September of that same year, California was admitted into the Union, meaning that Shasta County was even older than the state of California. Before Shasta County was named, Shasta residents held a town meeting in the middle of Main Street and named their town Shasta, presumably because Mount Shasta could be seen from the hills of the town. Originally, Mount Shasta was within Shasta County, but is now part of Siskiyou County. The original Shasta County included a major portion of Northern California, including Mount Shasta, and all the territory that later became Modoc, Lassen, and Siskiyou counties, as well as parts of the present-day Plumas and Tehama counties. Contributed by Dottie Smith.
She was of divine stock, not of men, in the forepart a lion, in the hinder a serpent, and in the midst a goat, breathing forth in terrible wise the might of a blazing fire. Homer's Iliad.
You're listening to Writing Roots, brought to you by Aspen House Publishing.
Welcome to Writing Roots. I'm Lee Hull.
And I'm Lee Esses. And that only took us 7 tries.
Just about. Our episode today is about the oldest kind of monster. The name is not quite so old, but we are using the term chimera for all of those monsters that are a mix of something.
Chimera tend to be monsters that are half this, half that, or part this, middle part this, end part this, like our quote suggested. But the oldest monster on record, as best we can tell, was the Löwenmensch, which is half man, half lion. I believe it was German. So I think the lion was mountain lion. But it doesn't take a whole lot of imagination to try to figure out how to create a monster if you're just taking Lego bits from this one and Lego bits from that one and sort of mashing them together.
And that really is what a chimera is. The term chimera comes from Homer's Iliad. That's kind of the earliest written record of it. But it's just a mix. And the reason why they're considered monsters is because they were seen as unnatural. Because they were a combination of things that should never be together, they should be feared.
Yeah, you see a lot of the mammal mixed with bird, mixed with humanoid, mixed with serpentine in some regard. If you have something that's somewhere between a cat and a dog, okay, that's not as terrifying as something somewhere between a cat and a hunting spider, because they're more separate.
And there's also a little subcategory of a chimera that tend to be riddlers. And we'll talk about the Sphinx a little bit later in this episode. So let's get into examples. One of the most common types of a chimera is a half-human of some kind.
Of course, the first thing that comes to mind is centaurs and fauns. As somebody who grew up reading The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe, fauns were a large part of my imagination. But you also have in Eastern cultures the tengu, which are a human-bird combination. There are a couple of different names for that, but that's the one that I learned first.
In Western cultures, adopted from Persia was the manticore, where it's seen as having a human head, the body of a lion, and the tail of either a scorpion or a porcupine.
I think the second's more terrifying.
Uh-huh. Especially in some of the descriptions I was reading, is that it would shoot out the spines from the tail and then regrow them almost instantly.
This needs to be in a movie at some point. You put it in your book, let me know. I want to see this.
Yes. And then, of course, you also have the Egyptian Sphinx, which is the Riddler, the very much seen as wise. If you can best it using your mind, then it won't eat you.
And I think Oedipus had a Sphinx in his story as well that was part of the prophecy that would bring about his own doom. But having a character be not only physically powerful, but witty, it's kind of a part of how characters can be better than their readers in a way. They can be heroic, not only by chopping off Medusa's head, but by figuring out how to see her, by being smart as well. And the Sphinxes tend to be an opportunity in a lot of Mediterranean mythology to showcase your character's brilliance.
The reason why the half-human monsters tend to be so scary is because it's an abomination of something that people are so familiar with. We know what humankind is. We know what it looks like. And if it looks different, especially in ancient cultures, it was to be feared.
And I think a lot of the before DC and Marvel superpower-type characters tended to be in this category, Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde, where he has this, in this case, mental half of him that is animal. And then you've got things like Spider-Man, where you have, he's half spider, half man. Your heroes can be in some way, but they tend to be conflicted.
So let's get on to some of the more interesting combinations, I guess you could say. The mix and match meshes of creatures. The origin of the word chimera is, like we said a little bit earlier, from Homer's Iliad. That is the lion head and body. There's a goat head in the middle with the goat udders and then a serpent's tail.
If you look throughout world history, you can find almost any two combinations in some regard. One of my favorites is an eagle in the front and a lion in the back. That's the griffin.
And kind of going along with that was introduced to, at least to me in the Harry Potter universe, is the hippogriff, where it's the eagle in the front and the horse in the back. This is not to be confused with the hippocamp, which will be covered when we talk about aquatic monsters next episode.
But it is also worthy of mentioning a chimera as well. And mermaids, again, half fish, half human.
And if you haven't quite figured it out, the griff part of the word is the eagle. The hippo is the horse. If you look at the root of the word, it can give you an idea of what the monster is. So another beast that is fairly common in Arthurian legends and then in some other places, we're going to describe it to you. And I want you to picture this creature. I want you to put the image together in your head.
This strange creature has the head and neck of a serpent, the body of a leopard, the haunches of a lion, and the feet of a deer. Do you have it? Are you picturing it in your head? What does it look like?
Well, what you described, the serpent head, a leopard body, lion back, and then hooves. But if you really break that down, it actually describes a giraffe.
The news from Town Hall is brought to you on KCNR Shasta Reading by Shasta Regional Medical Center. Your life, your health, your choice. Shasta Regional Medical Center.